off Weissman Street, I got lost for a while among signpost monikers I didn't recognize, but that probably commemorated people who became at least as embattled as Jabotinsky, Herzl, Weizmann, and Feisal. I emerged on Ben-Gurion Avenue. The first prime minister of Israel was a ferocious battler. He fought the British Mandate, the War of Liberation, Palestinian guerrillas, and the Sinai Campaign. He even won, most of the time, in the Israeli Knesset. And still, he was on the lookout for peace. In the months leading up to the Suez Crisis in 1956, President Dwight Eisenhower had a secret emissary shuttling between Jerusalem and Cairo. Egypt's president, Gamal Abdel Nasser, told the emissary, in words that Yasser Arafat could use and for all I know has, if the initiative Nasser was now taking in these talks was known in public, he would be faced not only with a political problem, but possibly with a bullet. A bullet was what Yitzhak Rabin got at the end of Ben-Gurion Avenue from a Jewish extremist during a peace rally in the square that now bears Rabin's name. A bullet was also what Emir Faisal's brother, King Abdullah of Jordan, got from a Muslim extremist for advocating peace with Israel. Nasser's successor, Anwar Sadat, got a bullet too. If bullets were the going price for moderation hereabouts, then I needed another drink. I walked west along Gordon Street, named, I hope, for Judah Lieb Gordon, the 19th century Russian novelist who wrote in classical Hebrew, and not for Lord George Gordon, the fanatical anti-Catholic and leader of the 1780 Gordon riots who converted to Judaism late in life and died in Newgate Prison praising the French Revolution. This brought me to the stretch of nightclubs along the beach promenade. Here, 2 months later, a suicide bomber would kill 22 people outside the Dolphy Disco. Most of the victims were teenage Russian girls, no doubt very moderate about everything other than clothes, makeup, and boyfriends. My tour guide arrived the next morning. His name was a long collection of aspirates, glottal stops, and gutturals with, like printed Hebrew, no evident vowels. "Americans can never pronounce it," he said. "Just call me Tzichv," spelled T-Z-C-H-V. I called him Z. I was Z's only customer. He drove a minibus of the kind that in the United States always seems to be filled with a church group. And so was Z's, until recently. "Most of my clients," he said, "are the fundamentalists. They want to go everywhere in the Bible. Ah, but now..." The people who talk incessantly about the last days have quit visiting the place where the world will end due to violence in the region. Z was 75, a retired colonel in the Israeli Defense Forces, a veteran of every war from liberation to the invasion of Lebanon. "Our worst enemy is CNN, he said. His parents had come from Russia in 1908 and settled on the first kibbutz in Palestine. Z was full of anger about the fighting in Israel, the fighting with the ultra-Orthodox Jews. "They don't serve in the army. They don't pay taxes. The government gives them money. I call them Pharisees." As we walked around, Z would greet people of perfectly secular appearance by name, adding, "You Pharisee, you," or would introduce me to someone in a t-shirt and jeans who had maybe voted for Ariel Sharon in the most recent election by saying, "I want you to meet Moshe, a real Pharisee, this one." Z said over and over, "The problem is with the Pharisees." About Arabs, I couldn't get him to say much. Z seemed to regard Arabs as he did weather. Weather is important. Weather is good. We enjoy weather. We respect weather. Nobody likes to be out in weather when it gets dramatic. "My wife won't let me go to the Palestinian areas," Z said. "Let's go to an ultra-Orthodox neighborhood," I said. "You don't want to go there," he said. "They're dumps. You want to see where Jesus walked by the Sea of Galilee?" "No, I don't." "And Jesus, walking by the Sea of Galilee, saw two brethren, Simon called Peter, and Andrew his brother, casting a net into the sea." For a man at loggerheads with religious orthodoxy, Z recited a lot of scripture, albeit mostly New Testament, where Pharisees come off looking pretty bad. When quoting, Z would shift to the trochaic foot, familiar to him, perhaps, from the preaching of his evangelical tourists, familiar to me from Mom yelling through the screen door, "You get in here right this minute!" As a compromise, we went to Haffa and had St. Peter's fish from the Sea of Galilee for lunch. Haffa is the old port city for Jerusalem, a quaint jumble of Arab architecture out of which the Arabs ran, or were run, depending on who's writing history, during Israel's War of Liberation. Like most quaint jumbles adjacent to quaintness-free cities, Haffa is full of galleries and studios. Israel is an admirably artsy place, and as in other artsy places of the contemporary world, admiration had to be aimed principally at the effort. The output indicated that Israelis should have listened when God said, "Thou shalt not make unto thee any graven image or any likeness of anything." Some of the abstract stuff was good. I wanted to look at art. Z wanted me to look at the house of Simon the Tanner on the Haffa waterfront. This, according to Acts 10:10-15, is where St. Peter went into a trance and foresaw a universal Christian church and also fitted sheets. Peter had a vision of a great sheet knit at the four corners and let down to the earth, wherein were all manner of four-footed beasts of the earth, and wild beasts and creeping things. God told Peter to kill them and eat them. Peter thought this didn't look kosher, or probably in the case of the creeping things, appetizing, and God said that what he had cleansed should not be called unclean. Then is when Peter knew Christianity was for everyone, not just the Jews, said Z with vicarious pride in another religion's generous thought. A little too generous. To Peter's idea, we owe ideology, the notion that the wonderful visions we have involve not only ourselves, but the whole world, whether the world wants to be involved or not. Until that moment of Peter's in Haffa, the killing of heretics and infidels was a local business. Take, for example, the case of John the Baptist, with Herodias, Herod Antipas, and stepdaughter Salome running the store. It was a mom-and-pop operation. But by the middle of the first century, theological persecution had gone global in the known world. Eventually, the slaughter would outgrow the limited market in religious differences. In the 20th century, millions of people were murdered on purely intellectual grounds. "Can we go in?" I asked. "No," Z said. "The Muslims put a mosque in there, which made the Orthodox angry. They rioted, which kept the Christians out, so the police closed the place." For those who dislike ideology, what's interesting about kibbutzim is that they're such a bad idea. Take an Eastern European intelligentsia and make the desert bloom. One would sooner take Mormons and start a rap label. But Kibbutz Yad Mordecai, 3/4 of a mile north of the Gaza Strip, passed the test of ideology. It worked, something no fully elaborated, universally applicable ideology ever does. I'd never been to a kibbutz. I don't know what I expected. Grossingers with guns? A bar mitzvah with tractors? Some of my friends went to kibbutzim in the 1960s and came back with tales of sex and socialism. But you could get that at Oberlin without the circle dancing. I'm sure my poli-sci major pals were very little help with the avocado crop. Anyway, what I wasn't expecting was a cluster of JFK-era summer cottages with haphazard flower beds, sagging badminton nets, and big wheel tricycles on the grass. Lake Misaukee, Michigan, without Lake Misaukee. A miniature Michigan of shrubbery and trees covered the low hills of the settlement, but with a network of drip irrigation lines weaving among the stems and trunks. Here were the fiber-optic connections of a previous and more substantive generation of high-tech visionaries who meant to treat a troubled world with water, per Al Sharpton, rather than information. Scattered in the greenery were the blank, metal-sided workshops and warehouses of present-day agriculture, suggestive more of light industry than of peasanthood. Yad Mordecai has light industry, too, producing housewares and decorative ceramics. Plus, it has the largest apiary in Israel, an educational center devoted to honey and bees, a gift shop, a kosher restaurant, and, of all things, 1,300 yards from the Gaza Strip, a petting zoo. Yad Mordecai was founded in 1943 on an untilled, sand-drifted patch of the Negev. The land was bought from the sheikh of a neighboring village. And there, in the humble little verb of the preceding sentence, is the moral genius of Zionism. Theodor Herzl, when he set down the design of Zionism in The Jewish State, 1896, wrote, "The land must, of course, be privately acquired. The Zionists intended to buy a nation rather than conquer one. This had never been tried, albeit various colonists, such as the American ones, had foisted purchase and sale agreements on peoples who had no concept of fee simple tenure or of geography as anything but a free good. But the Zionists wanted an honest title search. More than 100 years ago, the Zionists realized what nobody has realized yet. Nobody but a few cranky Austrian economists and some very rich people skimming the earth in Gulfstream jets. Nothing is zero sum. Not even statehood. Man can make more of everything, including the very thing he sets his feet on, as the fellow getting to his feet and heading to the bar on the GV can tell you. If we wish to found a state today," Herzl wrote, "we shall not do it in the way which would have been the only possible one 1,000 years ago." Whether the early Zionists realized what they had realized is another matter. Palestinian Arabs realized, very quickly, that along with the purchased polity came politics. In politics, as opposed to reality, everything is zero sum. Considering how things are going politically in Zion these days, the foregoing quotation from Herzl should be continued and completed. Supposing, for example, we were obliged to clear a country of wild beasts, we should not set about the task in the fashion of Europeans of the 5th century. We should not take spear and lance and go out singly in pursuit of bears. We should organize a large and lively hunting party, drive the animals together, and throw a Melanite bomb into their midst. On May 19, 1948, Yad Mordechai was attacked by an Egyptian armored column with air and artillery support. The kibbutz was guarded by 130 men and women, some of them teenagers, most without military training. They had 55 light weapons, one machine gun, and a 2-inch mortar. Yad Mordecai held out for 6 days, long enough for the Israeli army to secure the coast road to Tel Aviv. 26 of the defenders were killed, along with about 300 Egyptians. A slit trench has been left along the Yad Mordecai hilltop, with the original 55 weapons fastened to boards and preserved with tar. Under the viscous coatings, a 19th-century British rifle is discernible, and the sink-trap plumbing of 2 primitive Bren guns. The rest of the firearms look like the birds and cats that were once mummified by Egyptians, appropriately enough. Below the trench is a negligee lace of barbed wire, all the barbed wire the kibbutz had in 1948, and beyond that are Egyptian tanks, just where they stopped when they could go no farther. Between the tanks, dozens of charging Egyptian soldiers are represented by life-size, black-painted, two-dimensional cutouts. Gumby commandos. Lawn ornaments on attack. It was the only war memorial I've seen that was both frightening and silly. Things all war memorials should be. Most war memorials are sad or awful. Things, come to think of it, that war memorials should be also. And this war memorial had a price of admission, which, considering the cost of war, is another good idea. At the ticket booth was a crabby old guy whom Z greeted with warm complaining, grouch to grouch. Then Z took me to Yad Mordecai's Holocaust Museum, which skips pity and goes immediately to Jewish resistance during World War II and Jewish fighting in Palestine and Israel. Yad Mordecai is named for Mordecai Anielewicz, commander of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. The message of the Yad Mordecai Museum is that the Holocaust Memorial is in the trench at the other end of the kibbutz. This is the second wonderful thing about Zionism. It was right. Every other ism of the modern world was wrong about the nature of civilized man. Marxism, mesmerism, surrealism, pacifism, existentialism, nudism. But civilized man did want to kill Jews, and was going to do more of it. And Zionism was specific. While other systems of thought blundered around in the universal, looking for general solutions to comprehensive problems, Zionism stuck to its guns, or, in the beginning anyway, to its hose, mattocks, and irrigation pipes. True, Zionism has a utopian socialist aspect that is thoroughly nutty, as far as I'm concerned. But it's not my concern. No one knocks on my door during dinner and asks me to join a kibbutz or calls me on the weekend to persuade me to drop my current long-distance carrier and make all my phone calls by way of Israel. And given my last name, they won't. My last name is, coincidentally, similar to the maiden name of the Holocaust Museum docent, who was Baltimore Irish and had married a young man from the kibbutz and moved there in the 1970s. I converted, she said, which the Orthodox make it hard to do. But I went through with it. There's a crabby old guy here who sort of took me under his wing. The first Yom Kippur after I converted, he asked me, "Did you fast?" I said, "Yes." He said, "Stupid." You probably saw him on the way in, behind the ticket counter. He's a veteran of the fight for Yad Mordechai. There's a photograph of him here when they liberated the kibbutz in November 48. And there was the photo of the young, heroic, crabby old guy. And now he was behind the ticket counter at the War Memorial, not making a political career in Jerusalem or writing a book about the young heroic days or flogging his story to the History Channel. "How cool is that?" said the Baltimore Irish woman running the Holocaust Museum. Z and I had lunch at the kibbutz's self-serve restaurant, where Z took his plate of meat and sat in the middle of the dairy section. In the sky to the south, we could see smoke rising from the Gaza Strip, tires burning at an intifada barricade, or just trash being incinerated. Public services weren't what they might be in the Palestinian Authority at the moment. Or maybe it was one of the Jewish settlements in Gaza being attacked, although we hadn't heard gunfire. These settlements aren't farms, but mostly apartment clusters. Are the settlements in the West Bank and Gaza some kind of post-agricultural, post-industrial, high-rise Zionism, I asked Z? Or are they a government-funded, mondo-condo-live-dangerously parody of nation-building? Pharisees, said Z, and went back to eating. After lunch, we drove to Ben-Gurion's house in Tel Aviv, a modest, four-square, utterly unadorned structure. But the inside was cozy, with 20,000 books, in Hebrew, English, French, German, Russian, Latin, Spanish, Turkish, and ancient Greek. No fiction, however. A man who devoted his life to making a profound change in society was uninterested in the encyclopedia of society that fiction provides. Looking at the thick walls and heavy shutters, I wondered if the house had been built to be defended. Then I twigged to the purpose of the design and gained true respect for the courage of these Zionist pioneers. Ben-Gurion came to the Middle East before air conditioning was invented, and from Plonsk at that. We spent the next day, at my insistence and to Z's mystification, driving around the most ordinary parts of Israel, which look so ordinary to an American that I'm rendered useless for describing them to other Americans. American highway strip mall development hasn't quite reached Israel, however, so there's even less of the nondescript to not describe. Z and I stood in a garden apartment complex in Ashdod, in the garden part, a patch of trampled grass. "Here is the ugliest living in Israel," said Z. We went to a hill on the Ashdod shore, a tell, actually, a mound of ancient ruins, an ash heap of history from which we had a view of ash heaps, and the power plant that goes with them, which supplies half of Israel's electricity. Ashdod, incidentally, is a Philistine place name, not a pun. We could also see the container port, Israel's principal deep water harbor. "This is the place where the whale threw Jonah up," Z said. We went to the best suburbs of Tel Aviv, which looked like the second best suburbs of San Diego. We spent a lot of time stuck in traffic. Violence in the West Bank had forced traffic into bottlenecks on routes 2 and 4 along the coast, in a pattern familiar to anyone negotiating Washington, D.C.'s beltway, living in a place where you're scared to go to half of it, and the other half you can't get to. Israel is slightly smaller than New Jersey. Moses, in effect, led the tribes of Israel out of the District of Columbia, parted Chesapeake Bay near Annapolis, and wandered for 40 years in Delaware. From the top of Mount Nebo, in the equivalent of Pennsylvania, the Lord showed Moses all of Canaan. New Canaan is in Connecticut, but close enough. And there is a Mount Nebo in Pennsylvania, although it overlooks the Susquehanna rather than the promised land of, say, Paramus. Joshua blew the trumpet, and the walls of Paramus came tumbling down. Israel also has beaches that are at least as attractive as New Jersey's. An old friend of mine, Dave Garcia, flew in from Hong Kong to spend Easter in Jerusalem. "I like to go places when the tourists aren't there," he said. Dave spent 2 years in Vietnam when the tourists weren't there, as a prisoner of the Viet Cong. "Let's see where the Prince of Peace was born," he said. "It's in the middle of the Intifada." Z drove us from Ben-Gurion Airport to the roadblock between Jerusalem and Bethlehem. The highway was strewn with broken bottles, as if in the aftermath not of war, but of a bad party. Israeli soldiers and Palestinian Authority policemen stood around warily. Z handed us over to an Arab tour guide friend of his who drove a 25-year-old Mercedes and looked glum. Israel had lost half its tourism, but hotels in Palestinian areas were reporting occupancy rates of 4%. The Arab guide parked at random in the middle of empty Manger Square outside the Church of the Nativity. "There's normally a 3.5-hour wait," he said as we walked straight into the manger grotto. The little cave has been rendered a soot hole by millennia of offertory candles. It's hung with damp-stained tapestries and tarnished lamps and festoons of grimy ornamentation elaborate enough for a Byzantine emperor, if the Byzantine emperor lived in the basement. I imagine the Virgin Mary had the place done up more cheerfully, with little homey touches, when it was a barn. The only other visitors were in a tour group from El Salvador, wearing bright yellow T-shirts and acting cheerfully pious. Dave asked them, in Spanish, if, after all that El Salvador had been through with earthquakes and civil war, the fuss about violence and danger around here puzzled them. They shrugged and looked puzzled, but that may have been because no one in the Garcia family has been able to speak Spanish for 3 generations, including Dave. All the dead babies from the Massacre of the Innocents are conveniently buried 1 grotto over, under the same church. Sites of Christian devotion around Jerusalem tend to be convenient. In the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, the piece of ground where Christ's cross was erected, the stone where he was laid out for burial, and the tomb in which he was resurrected, plus where Adam's skull was buried and, according to early Christian cartographers, the center of the world, are within a few arthritic steps of one another. St. Helena, the mother of the Emperor Constantine, was over 75 when she traveled to the Holy Land in 326 A.D. looking for sacred locations. Arriving with a full imperial retinue and a deep purse, St. Helena discovered that her tour guides were able to take her to every place she wanted to go. Each turned out to be nearby and, as luck would have it, for sale. The attack of real estate agents in Palestine long predates Zionism. The Church of the Nativity is a shabby mess, a result of quarreling religious orders. The Greek Orthodox, Armenian Orthodox, and Roman Catholic priests have staked out nativity turf with the acrimonious precision of teenage brothers sharing a bedroom. A locked steel door prevents direct access from the Roman Catholic chapel to the manger grotto, which has to be reached through the Greek Orthodox monastery, where there is a particular Armenian beam that Greek Orthodox monks stand on to sweep the area above the grotto entrance, making the Armenians so angry that, according to my guidebook, in 1984 there were violent clashes as Greek and Armenian clergy fought running battles with staves and chains that had been hidden beneath their robes. What would Christ have thought? He might have thought, "Hand me a stave," per Mark 11:15. Jesus went into the temple and began to cast out them that sold and bought in the temple and overthrew the tables of the money changers. It's left to the Muslims to keep the peace at the Church of the Nativity in Bethlehem, just as it's left to the Jews to keep a similar peace at the likewise divided Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem. Who will be a Muslim and a Jew to the Muslims and the Jews? Hindus, maybe. That is more or less the idea behind putting UN peacekeeping troops in Israel. This may or may not work. The Bhagavad Gita opens with the hero Arjuna trying to be a pacifist. "Woe," Arjuna says, "we have resolved to commit a great crime as we stand ready to kill family out of greed for kingship and pleasures." But the Lord Krishna tells Arjuna to quit whining and fight. "Either you are killed and will then attain to heaven," Krishna says, "or you triumph and will enjoy the earth." Our guide took us to several large gift shops with no other customers, aisles stacked with unsold souvenirs of Jesus' birth. Part of the Israeli strategy in the Intifada has been to put economic pressure on the Arabs of the West Bank and Gaza. Fear of death hasn't stopped the Arabs. Maybe fear of Chapter 11 will do the trick. The entire hope of peace on earth rests with badly carved olive wood creche sets. Dave and I bought several. Then our guide took us up a hill to the Christian Arab village of Beit Jala, which the Israelis had been shelling. Large chunks were gone from the tall, previously comfortable-looking limestone villas. Shuttered house fronts were full of what looked like bullet holes, but large enough to put a popsicle in. "Ooh, 50 caliber," said Dave with professional appreciation. "These people," our guide said, "have no part in the violence." Dave and I made noises of condolence and agreement in that shift of sympathy to the nearest immediate victim that is the hallmark of 21st century morality. "Here, a man was sleeping in his bed," said our guide, showing us a 3-story pile of rubble, "and they couldn't find him for days later. The Israelis shell here for no reason." Said Dave, "why for no reason?" And our guide, speaking in diplomatic circumlocution, allowed as how every now and then, all the time, Palestinian gunmen would occasionally, very often, use the Beit Jala hilltop to shoot with rifles at Israeli tanks guarding a highway tunnel in the valley. They did it the next night. "It's kind of a rule of military tactics," said Dave to me, sotto voce, as we walked back to the car, "not to shoot a rifle at a tank when the tank knows where you are. Unless, of course, scanty olive wood creche set sails are spoiling your enjoyment of earth and you've decided to attain to heaven." The owner of an upscale antiquities store back in Bethlehem did not look as if he meant to attain any sooner than necessary, even though his store's air conditioning unit had been knocked out by Israelis firing on nearby rioters. He arrived in a new Mercedes with 3 assistants to open his business especially for Dave, his first customer in a month. The antiquities dealer was another friend of Z's. Z told us that this was the man whose grandfather was the Palestinian cobbler to whom the Dead Sea Scrolls were offered as scrap leather by the Bedouin shepherd who found them, a story too good to subject to the discourtesies of investigative journalism. The emporium was new, built in the soon-dashed hopes of millennium traffic. The antiquities were displayed with the stark, track-lit modern exhibition drama necessary to make them look like something other than the pots and pans and jars and bottles from people who had, one way or another, given up on this place long ago. Dave collects antiques, but by profession he's an iron and steel commodities trader. He has also lived in Asia for years. I sat on a pile of rugs and drank little cups of coffee while Levantine bargaining met Oriental dickering and the cold-eyed brokerage of the market floor. The 3 great world traditions of haggle flowered into confrontation for 2.5 hours. Folks from the Oslo talks and the Camp David meetings should have been there for benefit of instruction. Everyone ended up happy. No fatal zero-sum thinking was displayed as banknotes and ceramics changed hands at last. Dave could make more money, and the Arabs could make more antiquities. Why can't everybody just get along? No reasonably detached person goes to Israel without being reduced in philosophical discourse to the level of Rodney King, or, for that matter, to the level of George Santayana. "Those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it," Santayana said, in one of those moments of fatuousness that come to even the most detached of philosophers. In Israel and Palestine, as in Serbia and Kosovo, it goes double for those who can't remember anything else. And everybody does get along. After a fashion, Muslims and Christians and Jews have lived together in the Holy Land for centuries, hating one another's guts, cutting one another's throats, and touching off wars of various magnitudes. The whole melodrama of the Middle East would be improved if amnesia were as common here as it is in the plots of imaginary melodramas. I was thinking this as I was looking at the Dead Sea Scrolls in the solemn underground shrine of the book inside the vast precincts of the Israel Museum. Maybe, I thought, all the world's hoary old tracts ought to wind up as loafer souls or be auctioned at Sotheby's to a greedy, high-tech billionaire for display in his otherwise bookless 4,000-square-foot cyber den. Then I noticed that Z was reading the scrolls, muttering aloud at speed, perusing an ancient text with more ease than I can read Henry James. What's past is past, perhaps, but when it passed, this was where it went. Z dropped us at the King David Hotel, the headquarters of the Palestinian Mandate Administration when the British were trying to keep the peace. In 1946, the hotel was blown up by the radical wing of the Jewish resistance movement, the Irgun. Some of every group were killed. 41 Arabs, 28 British, 17 Jews, and 5 reasonably detached persons of miscellaneous designation. The Irgun was led by the future Prime Minister Menachem Begin, who would make peace with Egypt in the 1970s, but then again, war with Lebanon in the 1980s. On the way to the hotel, Z explained why there will always be war in the region. Israel is strategic, he said in his most New Testamental tone. It is the strategic land bridge between Africa and Asia. For 5,000 years there has been fighting in Israel. It is the strategic land bridge. And the fighting continues, a sort of geopolitical muscle memory, as though airplanes and supertankers hadn't been invented. The English and the French might as well be fighting over the beaver pelt trade in Quebec today, and from what I understand of Canadian politics, they are. We were meeting Israeli friends of Dave's at the hotel, a married couple. He voted for Sharon, she voted for Ehud Barak. Dave and I marked our lintels and doorposts with the blood of the lamb, metaphorically speaking, and drank Israeli vodka and orange juice. There will always be war, the husband said, because with war, Arafat is a hero, and without war, he's just an unimportant guy in charge of an unimportant place with a lot of political and economic problems. There will always be war, the wife said, because with war, Sharon is a hero, and without war, he's just an unimportant guy in charge of an unimportant place with... Also, war is fun, from a distance. Late the next night, Dave and I were walking back to our hotel in Arab East Jerusalem. Dave was wearing a Hawaiian shirt, and I was in a blazer and chinos. We couldn't have looked less Israeli if we had been dressed like Lawrence of Arabia, who, incidentally, was a third party to the cordial meeting between Chaim Weizmann and the Emir Faisal. 50 yards down a side street, a couple of Palestinian teenagers jumped out of the shadows. Using the girly overhand throw of nations that mostly play soccer, one kid threw a bottle at us. It landed 40 yards away. On Good Friday, Dave and Z and I walked from the Garden of Gethsemane to the Lion's Gate, where Israeli paratroopers fought their way into the old city during the Six-Day War. We traveled the Via Dolorosa in an uncrowded quiet that Jesus Christ and those paratroopers were not able to enjoy. We owed our peace in Jerusalem to an enormous police presence. This did Jesus no good. Nor did the Jordanian police give Israeli soldiers helpful directions to the Ecce Homo Arch. And our Savior and the heroes of 1967 didn't have a chance to stop along the way and bargain with Arab rug merchants. Z and the rug merchants exchanged pessimisms, Z grousing about Sharon and the Arabs complaining about Arafat. The Israeli army tells Arafat where the strikes will come, one shopkeeper said. They tell him, don't be here. Don't be there. No one tells me. I visited the 14 stations of the cross and said my prayers, for peace, of course, although as a Zionist friend of mine puts it, victory would be okay, too. Jesus said, love your enemies. He didn't say not to have any. In fact, he said, I came not to send peace, but a sword. Or anyway, staves and chains. Then we went to the Wailing Wall, the remnant of the Second Temple, built by the same Herod the Great who killed all the babies buried by the manger in Bethlehem. Atop the Wailing Wall stands the Haram al-Sharif, with the Dome of the Rock enclosing Mount Moriah, where Abraham was ready to kill Isaac, and where, at that moment, Muslims gathered for Friday prayers were surrounded by Israeli soldiers, some of both, no doubt, also ready to kill. The Dome of the Rock marks the center of the world for those who don't believe that the center of the world is down the street in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. In the plaza in front of the Wailing Wall, religious volunteers were lending yarmulkes to Jews who had arrived bareheaded. Well, Dave said, my mother was Jewish, so I guess that makes me Jewish. I'd better get a rent-a-beanie and go over to the Wailing Wall and wail or something. The yarmulkes being handed out were, unaccountably, made of silver reflective fabric. I look like an outer space Jew, Dave said. I always thought you were Catholic, I said. Because of Garcia, Dave said. Like O'Rourke? I said, but I'm not Catholic either. My mother was Presbyterian and I'm Methodist. I came home from Methodist confirmation class in a big huff and told my mother there were huge differences between Presbyterians and Methodists. And my mother said, we sent you to the Methodist church because all the nice people in the neighborhood go there. They could use that church here, Dave said. Dave swayed in front of the wall like the Orthodox surrounding him, although, frankly, in a manner more aging pop fan than Hasidic. What could cause more hatred and bloodshed than religion? This is the Israel question. Except it isn't rhetorical. It has an answer. We went to Yad Vashem, the Jerusalem Holocaust Memorial, and saw what the godless get up to. There are worse things than war, if the Intifada is indeed a war. As of May 2001, 513 Palestinians and 124 Israelis had been killed in what is called the Second Intifada. About 40,000 perished in the 1992 through 96 civil war in Tajikistan that nobody's heard of. From 1.5 to 2 million are dead in Sudan. There are parts of the world where the situation Dave and I were in is too ordinary to have a name. Late Saturday night, the particular place where we were in that situation was the American Colony Hotel in East Jerusalem, sometimes called the PLO Hotel, for the supposed connections the staff has. It is the preferred residence of Intifada-covering journalists, especially those who are indignant about Israeli behavior. The American Colony Hotel was once the mansion of an Ottoman pasha. Dave and I sat among palms in the peristyle courtyard, surrounded by arabesques carved in Jerusalem's golden limestone. The bedroom temperature air was scented with Easter lilies, and in the distance, now and then, gunfire could be heard. This country is hopeless, Dave said, pouring a Palestinian Teba beer to complement a number of Israeli Maccabee beers we'd had earlier in West Jerusalem. And as hopeless places go, it's not bad. We discussed another Israel question. Why are Israeli girls so fetching in their army uniforms? It may have something to do with their carrying guns. But Freud was a lukewarm Zionist, and let's not think about it. After the first Zionist Congress in 1897, the rabbis of Vienna sent a delegation to Palestine on a fact-finding mission. The delegation cabled Vienna saying, "The bride is beautiful, but she is married to another man." However, the 20th century, with all its Freudianism, was about to dawn, and we know what having the beautiful bride married to another man means in today's melodramas. No fair using amnesia as a device for tidy plot resolution. Do we have to choose sides? Dave said. But it's like dating sisters. Better make a decision or head for the global village limits. And speaking of sisters, I opened the Jerusalem Post on Easter morning and discovered that my sister's neighborhood in Cincinnati was under curfew, overrun with race riots. 4. 9/11 Diary. September 11th, 2001. When the Pentagon was hit, Debbie Lehan, the manager of my apartment building in Washington, D.C., and Damon Boone, the building engineer, moved their cars out of the underground garage and parked them to block both ends of the building's horseshoe drive. Of course, that was absurd, as if the terrorists had thought, World Trade Center, Pentagon, and a place on Connecticut Avenue where Naomi Wolf used to live. But by noon, all the building's children had been gathered home from school or daycare. The children played in the empty half-oval. Career daddies and career mommies hovered. The barricaded driveway was absurd, if you could keep your eyes from misting.
Better to do something, Debbie said.
Damon unlocked the door to the building's roof. We could see the Pentagon on fire across the Potomac.
It makes me angry, scared, sad all at once, said Damon.
According to the theory of terrorism, it was supposed to make him paralyzed with terror. The traffic on Connecticut Avenue was coming from downtown as if in the evening rush hour, but there was none of the accustomed honking at the district's unsequenced and haphazardly placed stoplights. Downtown, the cars were gone, and the stores were closed. Police officers stood in ones and twos. On the corner of F and 14th Streets, two businessmen, two messengers, and a panhandler were listening to the panhandler's portable radio. A tape of President Bush's first response to the terrorist attack was being broadcast. One of the messengers said, in the voice people use when they're saying something important, "After today, things will never be the same." Then he seemed to have one of those moments that came to everyone on September 11th, with jumbled thoughts alike in size but wildly mismatched in weight. Pity, rage, and how to get the shirts back from the dry cleaner. "Transportation in the air won't be as fast," he said in a smaller voice. At the corner of 14th and Constitution, a policeman set out flares to block the street. The policeman took the plastic caps off the flares and tossed the caps aside with the decisive gesture of a man suspending minor public mores in a crisis. A young man on a bicycle stopped at the curb and said to me, "At least the grocery stores are open, but the trucks can't get to the stores. If it's going to be a big international war, I'll just fast." The young man had a theory that the terrorism had to do with America's pulling out of the UN conference on racism in South Africa, but he was interrupted by a woman indignant that the portable toilets at the Washington Monument were still in use. "They don't know what I could be doing in there," she said. The grass expanse in the middle of the mall was deserted except for the homeless, suddenly homeless alone. Like everyone else, they seemed subdued, although they didn't stay subdued. The next day, at 18th and L, I would see a ragged man in the middle of the street shouting, "I'll kill all of you people! I don't like any of you!" No one, including the soldiers who were by then everywhere in Washington, paid attention. Michelle Lieber, a lobbyist who lives in my building, had come downtown with me. Alongside the mall, snack and souvenir trucks were dutifully open. Michelle asked the snack truck proprietor if business was good. "Yes, of course," he dutifully said. That day, for the first time in 13 years in Washington, I saw no protesters. And hardly any were around on Wednesday. A reopened Lafayette Park would feature only an old woman with a sign saying, "White House Anti-Nuclear Peace Vigil Since 1981," and a middle-aged hippie on a similar anti-nuclear sleepout, "Since 1984. The old woman was talking mostly to herself. "They provoked what happened," she said. The hippie was talking to two adolescent girls with piercings, discussing his pet squirrel. On Tuesday afternoon, even TV crews were mostly absent from the White House vicinity. On Constitution at the Ellipse, ABC White House correspondent Terry Moran was on a lone stand-up, not saying much to the camera. A few people gathered around. "We just got here from Slovakia, and everything happened," a tourist said. Michelle and I had walked to the reflecting pool behind the Capitol before we saw any more tourists. A family in sports clothes was standing there, looking baffled. I introduced myself to the father, and his first words were, "One is grateful for not having a conspiratorial turn of mind. We're from Slovakia." "We're a bit concerned," the father said.
But the weather is okay. We had only one day to be here. Tomorrow, we are supposed to go to New York. Michelle, on her cell phone, was trying to call friends in New York. She kept getting a recorded message. Due to the tornado, your call cannot go through. At Bullfeathers, a restaurant on First Street, Representative Don Sherwood, Republican from the 10th District in Pennsylvania, was having lunch with his daughter. He wanted a session of Congress to be convened at the Capitol that night. We should be as visible and in business as possible, he said. Four or five televisions were on inside the restaurant, their volume turned up. Another congressman and his female aide were in the men's room, the only place quiet enough for the congressman to do a phone interview. The congressman was saying, "We will make the people who did this pay. It is awfully hard to defend yourself from people who have no respect for human life." He seemed to be pulling in two directions, as did the soldiers on the streets the next day. Camouflaged for invisibility, and wearing blaze orange traffic control vests. "We just have to quit being Americans for a little while," said a staffer from the Republican National Committee. "Forget about carrying our Constitution to people who don't give a rat's ass." Michelle and I walked across Capitol Hill. On Massachusetts, we met a Senate staffer whom Michelle knew. He was jogging. "It was a little hairy when they told us to evacuate," he said. "Then I saw our F-16s fly over, and I felt okay." We met another Senate staffer who was trying to get his car out of a parking lot that was inside the police cordon around the Capitol. The four of us walked to the Dubliner Bar on North Capitol Street. "The congressional leadership," said the second staffer, "has been whisked off to an undisclosed location. As far as I'm concerned, they can keep most of them there." This touched on another theory of terrorism, that the organization of society can be attacked by striking at organizations, that we can't organize things ourselves. "Four Guinness," the first Senate staffer said to the bartender. "Time to take sides," the second staffer said. "Time to turn sand into glass," said the first. Ariel Sharon was on CNN. "It is a war between the good and the bad," said Sharon. From the Dubliner, we took a cab to the Palm Restaurant on 19th Street. The bar and the dining room were full. President Bush came on television at 8:30. Everyone has seen, in movies, a restaurant go quiet. I had never before really heard all talk come to a halt and all noise from tableware cease. The customers and staff applauded when the president said, "We will make no distinction between the people who committed these acts and the people who harbor them." As I was driving in to open for lunch, the Palm's assistant general manager, Jocelyn Czar, said, "All the traffic was going the other way. 10 minutes after the Pentagon was hit, I was getting reservations. I'm thinking, aren't these people watching the news?" But they were. They just wanted to be with other people. I told the staff that if anyone wanted to go home, just go. No one did. I opened early. People were streaming in. My only fear was putting a group of people in danger. Once I got past that, I thought, the Palm is the center point. Everyone wanted to come and sit at the bar and talk. Smith and Walensky called and asked what I was going to do. I said I was staying open. All the evening staff showed up. A friend called and said, "You shouldn't be working when thousands of people died. But what else am I going to do?" On Monday night, September 10th, I had finished an article for The Atlantic about Israel, an article that appears as the previous chapter in this book. Israel is a country that has been under terrorist attack for generations, forever. On Tuesday, I didn't want to publish that article. It wasn't serious enough. I was thinking, after today, things will never be the same. Lines from W.H. Auden's poem, September 1st, 1939, kept coming to mind. "Waves of anger and fear circulate over the bright and darkened lands of the earth." By Wednesday, I realized I had never known what Auden was getting at with that poem, except perhaps in "As the clever hopes expire of a low, dishonest decade." Apt enough, but "where blind skyscrapers use their full height to proclaim the strength of collective man." What's that crap? Or this, "Ironic Points of light flash out whenever the just exchange their messages. Anyway, Auden repudiated the poem, mostly because of the fatuous line, "We must love one another or die." Or just die. And neither agape nor eros is an appropriate response to Osama bin Laden. Also, Auden was the Englishman who, when World War II loomed, acted as Hitler would have had Englishmen act. He ran to America and stayed there. In Israel, on September 11th, things were the same as ever. September 30th, 2001. Traveling to London from Washington 12 days after the terrorist attack, I expected security measures. I had been told to arrive at Dulles Airport 3 hours before departure. I was ready for checkpoints where people in flak jackets would use mirrors to look for bombs under cars, although nowadays, with automotive electronics and the puzzle plumbing of emissions control, everything under cars looks like a bomb. Anyway, the checkpoints weren't there. At the ticket counter, instead of being asked once, "Has your luggage been under your control at all times?" I was asked twice. The metal detectors and X-ray machines were operated by the usual dim but friendly minimum-wage security guards, now somewhat less friendly. I was told to hand over my disposable lighter to prevent, I suppose, any threat of, "Do what I say or I'll light this Marlboro and you'll all die in 30 years due to inhalation of secondhand smoke." I headed cheerlessly to the designated smoking area, expecting to find a room full of desperate, fireless people paying black market prices for Nicorette. Everyone was smoking. I asked for a light, and someone produced a disposable lighter. It seems that if you went through one of the airport's two security portals, you were made to surrender all lighters and matches, but if you went through the other... Concern had been voiced that fear of terrorism could lead to renewed racial profiling. Never mind that the languages of the Taliban, Pashto and Dari, are part of the Indo-European linguistic family, and that if Caucasian has any meaning at all, Afghans have a better claim to it than Hungarians or Finns. The profiling at the boarding gate couldn't be called racial, exactly. The ruddy and the pallid were ushered directly on board, as were the sufficiently black. It was the tanned or swarthy who had to line up for additional questioning. On my flight, these included, as far as I could tell, some Hindus, some Filipinos, an Hispanic or two, and a pair of elderly Iranian women wearing chadors in violation of the new American "no unusual things on your head" taboo that has brought grief to Sikhs in the U.S. hinterland. Not that there hasn't been Sikh terrorism, but it was directed against Indira Gandhi in retaliation for the Indian Army storming the Golden Temple at Amritsar. This isn't an issue at the moment, but the complexities of building an international coalition against terrorism could lead to India demanding a wholesale revocation of Sikh cab licenses in New York, thereby bringing that city to a halt again. An English friend asked me, "Would a bald chap who was sunburned and was gardening and put a tea towel on his head be in trouble in America?" My plane was two-thirds empty, but the unflappable British flight crew was unflapped. I was not subjected to the indignity that an acquaintance suffered on a flight from New York to Chicago. He was made to press the flight attendant call button and identify himself before being allowed to go to the bathroom. This, for a drinking man in the enlarged prostate years, is a serious violation of civil rights. The people I know in Great Britain were in the same state of shock and anger as the people I know in America, and, like my American friends, they weren't particularly frightened of a second terrorist strike, or of poison gas or germ warfare. But this may be a matter of being old smokers and drinkers, of an age for cardiac arrest and malignancy, with children they'd like to see grow up, or at least get a damn job, and retirement funds that had gone to hell during the previous year. How much more frightening can life get? The Brits, however, were more likely to raise the subject of the IRA and say a word about America leading the fight against terrorism while letting the NORAID cans be passed in the bars of Southie and the Bronx. I blamed the Kennedys, always a safe course when questions of bad U.S. political policies are raised. Meanwhile, it's the British themselves who were at the negotiating table with my moron cousins from Ulster. Personally, I'd start the war on terrorism with Gerry Adams. At least we know where he is. Incidentally, it's ridiculous, if you're Irish, to claim that you can't fathom the mindset behind the wild destruction of innocence, the casual self-murder, and the bathos of martyrdom on September 11th. Al-Qaeda probably has a Yeats of its own. A terrible beauty is born. But there was something going on in Great Britain, among the people I don't know, that was more troubling than Northern Ireland home rule concessions. The September 17th issue of The New Statesman ran an amazing editorial leader. Look at the pictures on pages 6 and 7, showing Americans running in terror from the New York explosions, and then ask yourself how often in the past, particularly in Vietnam and more recently in Iraq, you have seen people running in terror from American firepower. American bond traders, you may say, are as innocent and as undeserving of terror as Vietnamese or Iraqi peasants. Well, yes and no. To quote Moore, might set off a wave of retribution in America against people wearing derby hats. I had dinner with the critic and television commentator Clive James and his assistant. The assistant was an able and well-educated young woman who could not be convinced by Clive that, in the matter of moral values, there was such a thing as a superior culture. "They cover their women in the ballroom drapes," Clive said. "Your dad can have you stoned to death for not marrying some old goat." "I wouldn't call it an inferior culture," his assistant said. "What about Somalia? What about clitoridectomies?" "Of course I'm a feminist," his assistant said, "but I resist the idea of an inferior culture." It's usually Clive and I who have the arguments. He is a liberal Democrat, but he's my age. He remembers when the whole point of being on the left was the effort, alas, misplaced, to forge a superior culture. I was a guest on a BBC radio phone-in talk show. If the world is mad at America for anything, it should be for invention of the phone-in talk show. The idea of a news broadcast once was to find someone with information and broadcast it. The idea now is to find someone with ignorance and spread it around. Being ignorant myself, I'm not mad personally. A woman named Rona called and said we didn't have enough empathy for the poor people in the world. We're so rich and they're so poor. No wonder they're angry. I told her that was a slur on poor people. And anyway, Osama bin Laden is a rich twit. Rona said that we are so wealthy and materialistic and they are so deprived. "Here I am," she said, "just an ordinary suburban housewife and a semi-detached, and I'm surrounded by all these things I don't need." Privately, I was thinking that my moron cousins from Belfast could fix that with breaking and entering. I said, "You're arguing completely beside the point." She was employing a fallacy of relevance, specifically what's called in logic, argumentum ad misericordiam, although I had to look that up later. What I said on the radio was, "So what?" Rona accused me of that most grievous of contemporary sins, especially when committed against a woman by a middle-aged man. "Don't patronize me," she said. Calls and emails were 9-1 in Rona's favor, but one stalwart sent this message. "I suspect why 90% of callers are not in favor of PJ's opinions is because they are out-of-work socialists who have nothing better to do but phone radio stations." And there are some of their ilk in the United States. Back in Washington, I went to a peace rally on September 29th at Freedom Plaza near the White House. Several thousand people attended. As I arrived, a man on the speaker's platform was saying, "We cannot permit the president of our country to claim there are only two forces, good and evil. We are not with either." The bread and puppet theater troupe was carrying a score of what appeared to be 8-foot-high, papier-mâché baked potatoes. Asked what this was about, one of the troupe said it represented naked people being oppressed by clothed people. Asked again, she said the same thing. Members of another performing arts group were wearing cardboard bird heads and flapping bedsheets. They said they were the cranes of peace. A woman asked for signatures on a petition in favor of affirmative action. The National Youth Rights Association had set up a card table.